Hi, Glenn. How are you doing?
Doing well, John. Welcome to the Glenn Show. Glenn Lowry here of Brown University, speaking with my nemesis, my debating partner, my blogging heads, colleague, John McWhorter of Columbia University, and various other affiliations.
So, Glenn, we're back to reparations.
John, so Ta-Nehisi Coates has this long piece in the Atlantic Monthly, which has drawn a lot of attention, making the case for reparations. And you have a column in the Daily Beast arguing about why you don't think that's such a good idea. And that's what we're talking about. So why don't you get us started by telling us, you want to summarize Ta-Nehisi Coates's argument, and you want to tell us what your rebuttal is?
Reparations in general, and this has been being discussed really for 100 years beyond, but I think it had a real efflorescence in the late 90s and the early 2000s. And this is really a revival of an argument that has been made for a while. Is that back pay is owed for the unpaid work that slaves did. And probably more importantly, that the black community needs to be given some sort of restitution for even the Jim Crow practices and the lynching and the redlining and all of the hideous injustice that happened after slavery. Now, Coates's piece is something a little different from that. Coates talks about the money aspect, but he doesn't seem to be terribly interested in it. Coates is more interested in another wing of race argument, which is that what the reparations would be for is for the United States to finally face the racist evils of its past, and that we need to have a national reconciliation, a national airing of grievance, a national understanding of what has helped to ruin the black past and its effects on the black present. That's what he's really writing about. And so the question is, do we need to have not only the payment, but also does the nation need to come to terms with the black past, present, and probably future? And that's where we are.
Okay, and your rebuttal.
My rebuttal of the payment issue is something that I wrote about extensively back in 2001 and on. Reparations was a big issue on the race scene, really until 9/11. 9/11 kind of wiped it away, and after that there was Hurricane Katrina and then the rise of Obama. But for a little while there, there were endless forums about this, magazine articles, etc. And in terms of the money, I said I'm all for reparations. I completely understand the idea that we have to get beyond the idea that black people were slaves and then they just have to crawl back up. But I said back then that there already were reparations, and I believe this now. Reparations is affirmative action. Reparations is the reform and expansion of welfare starting in the late 60s. Reparations is scholarships. Reparations is the expansion of Black History Month. I really think that reparations happened in the late 60s and the early 70s, and you can even find some evidence of people calling them that. Now, then, my argument against the national conversation is something different, but let's start with the money argument. Would you say that what happened, the war on poverty, basically was reparations, but it just wasn't called that, which is what my argument has been about that?
No, I wouldn't say that.
Okay. No?
And observing that, I'm not making a case for or against reparations as such. I'd like to be able to come back to that. I would say, though, that I would want to draw a very sharp line between the development of institutions at the national level oriented toward dealing with, questions of poverty, unemployment, poor schooling, poor housing, lack of access to health care, and so on. I draw a distinction between such policies, which are national policies about citizenship. They are universal. They are relevant to everybody who is a citizen, and they are a part of the nation's expression of what our obligations are to each other as citizens. And I would distinguish between all such activities and anything that might have a concentrated or targeted intention to benefit, compensate, ameliorate for a particular group of persons. So the language of reparations is a language about the black community. Let's put that in heavy inverted commas. It's a collective claim. It's a claim on behalf of a subset of the population over and against the other. And it's very different, in my mind, from expressions of solidarity that are universal and that apply to the nation as a whole. Now, whether you like or don't like the war on poverty or the expansion of welfare or whatever, those are policies that are of the former kind in my, you know, my development here, of the kind that are about social solidarity and that are national and universal, and not of the latter kind. They're not particularistic. They're not group specific. They're not meant to compensate one group of Americans over and against another group of Americans. That's how I would see it.
So
no, that's not reparations. Neither is affirmative action, quote, reparations, close quote. Although, again, I'm not trying to make a case for reparations. I think we should come to that. But I'm just saying that the idea that, let's say, a university wants to have a diverse student body and feels that it serves the educational mission poorly to the extent that it does not admit and educate a decent number of African Americans, that may be a good idea, maybe a terrible idea, but I don't regard it as, you know, a reckoning with our racist past kind of repair or compensation for, you know, unpaid labor or anything of that sort.
Aren't you being a little theoretical, though, about the abstraction of these ideas versus what really drove them in history? My thought was always that affirmative action, especially in our times, can be phrased and meant as something about diversity that goes far beyond poor black people. But affirmative action wouldn't have existed if it weren't for the nation waking up to the plight of specifically black people. Starting in the 1960s was always my impression. Welfare expansion certainly wasn't phrased as let's do something for the blacks, but it was, in the historical sense, a direct response to especially the long hot summers. That's when the National Welfare Organization got started, and that was a movement that was about black women, not poverty in the sort of Barbara Ehrenreich working portions. The war on poverty, we know that Bobby Kennedy was first struck by Walker Evans style poverty, but very quickly the Great Society became identified with an effort to do something about the evils of Jim Crow. So for me, it was what people were thinking, black and white.
I don't think that's true, John.
Really?
No, I don't. I think that Michael Harrington's book, The Other America, which was a important, you know, journalistic slash intellectual intervention that helped to promote ideas about the war on poverty, was not only about, I mean, of course, it did touch on the, you know, the blighted lives of people who lived in segregated racial ghettos in America's big cities. But it also talked, as you mentioned, a lot about rural poverty and the hill country of Tennessee and Alabama and all. And I think when Lyndon Johnson comes out of Texas and rises to the presidency and sees himself at mid-20th century as the leader of a transformation of American social policy that included Medicare and Medicaid, as well as the, you know, various urban development initiatives and anti-poverty interventions, that he didn't see himself as specifically responding to black concerns, although, of course, that was an important part of the picture. And I also think of the book by your colleague, Ira Katznelson, when Affirmative Action Was White, who recounts the development of the New Deal in the 1930s and 40s, the labor law liberalizations, and the GI Bill initiatives as large-scale social policies that blacks didn't benefit so much from because of segregation, but it was a kind of quote affirmative action, close quote, in his metaphor. That had nothing to do specifically with black people. So, you know, all of that's to say, I just think it's a little bit more complicated than that. These programs were a reaction to the claims of blacks, but I'm not sure that that's getting us to the heart of the matter, which is what's wrong with a backward looking, you know, look at the conditions of African Americans today. It has a lot to do with a blighted history that we should be ashamed of. And shouldn't we not lose track of that history and be motivated in our reaction to the problems of blacks today by a recognition that history has cast a long shadow?
The hardest thing I think that we're dealing with is that I think what somebody like Coates wants us to think, and we also have to think about Charles Blow's piece in the New York Times yesterday on Sunday, where he thinks of himself as kind of schooling Mike Cuban, who has
Mark Cuban.
Mark Cuban, pardon me, I didn't get much sleep last night, in his comment about opening up to his fear of a certain kind of young black man. I think the idea is that we're supposed to see Black America's problems today as legacies of not just slavery. I don't think anybody is serious is making that argument as vigorously as they may have in 1966, but also Jim Crow, the long sequence of injustices done to Black people. And we're supposed to see the problems and think all of this is a legacy of then. And I think the problem with bringing the nation together into an understanding of that argument is that it's gotten so fragile. I really have a, and this is something we've talked about before, but so long ago that I feel like we can go back to it. I can't see convincing a representative body of even intelligent, enlightened people who are trying to understand that if we see, for example, the level of violence among many young black men, and we all regret it. We seek the causes. We know that it has nothing to do with something that is endemic to being a young black man, but it's a problem. We're supposed to be telling America that the reason for that kind of violence is racism, and let's call it institutional racism. And we're supposed to say something along the lines of it's because they have no hope. But I think that even the ordinary person can look around the world or even around the country and see a great many groups of people, not just individuals, groups of people who don't have hope, who might have self-respect problems, where that violence isn't the response. I think even an enlightened person these days can say we've gone beyond the idea that when something is going wrong in certain communities, it must be due to racism, both overt and institutional. And that's what a reparations realization would require. That's what Ta-Nehisi Coates is waiting for. And I don't see these issues as clear enough for that kind of consensus to happen, given how hard it was to even come up with the kind of consensus that created the Civil Rights Act of 1964. You know what I mean?
I think I do, and I'd add to this critique that you're offering here of a line of argument that says, yes, there may be school failure. Yes, there may be family disruption. Yes, there may be kind of disconnection from the labor market and overdependence on public assistance. And yes, there may be criminal activity and violence and overrepresentation in the courts and in the jails. But all of that is a consequence of a racist history of denial of opportunity and so forth and so on. And that is an argument that has grown tired, I hear you saying, and that's not persuading many people outside of the community, even though they may genuflect, they may, out of a kind of politically correct politeness, nod in affirmation when they hear this argument. They don't really believe it. I think that's
But
right,
if
but
I
I just
could,
want.
just a very quick interjection, I wouldn't say tired. I would say the argument has always been so torturous. It's so subtle that I don't think that it can be a general matter of consensus. Go ahead.
Well, I think there's an agency issue here that also should be mentioned. That is, if indeed the negative aspects of contemporary African American life are laid at the feet of history, slavery and Jim Crow made us do it, then one is tempted to think in similar terms about some of the positive aspects of life. I mean, you want to take credit for stuff, but you've already surrendered agency. You've sort of said we're the creatures of our past. We don't have the capacity to make our own lives in our own way, and that is something that has always troubled me. On the other hand, I do want to say this though: the stark disparities. I mean, you mentioned the violence thing, and the numbers are just, like half the homicides in a given year in the country are committed by black men under 30 years old, mostly against one another. It's no surprise that someone like Mark Cuban might remark that, he's afraid of them, even though we know that someone like George Zimmerman, who shot and killed Trayvon Martin, isn't justified in his, in his stereotyping and his
Of course, right.
paranoia. We don't defend those actions at all. But, it's hard for someone living in an American city not to notice some of these things and for their behavior not to be influenced by it. And the idea that you'd want to not simply have those reactions attributed to the shortcomings of black people, but you remember when the president said, and he got criticized for it, to business people who were against taxes. He says, "You got a business, you've been successful. You didn't build that. You didn't build it on your own. You didn't build it without roads that worked, without a legal system that was accountable, without all the infrastructure that allows for you to build a successful business and requires public dollars." The president was saying, "Well, a similar thing could be said the other way. All of the depressed." Even depraved, it's a strong word, but you might want to use it on occasion. Violent, antisocial, self-destructive, not seizing opportunity. These depressed communities and these blighted people didn't get that way on their own. They're not just solely responsible for their failure, just like a businessman isn't solely responsible for his success. The society is implicated in some way. And the political conversation will look very different if that implication of society in the failures of communities and individuals is recognized explicitly.
Definitely. But what worries me is that we're not even going to be allowed to have a conversation of that kind of clarity. And Charles Blow's piece yesterday, Charles Blow's, I really did not sleep enough last night. Charles Blow's piece yesterday was really a beautiful example in that. We're talking about the crime statistics, whereas what Charles Blow implies is that if you even think that way, you are simply stereotyping, that you have had your brain infected by a certain way of looking at things, and the statistics somehow don't matter. And I know personally that that's the sort of thing that you run up against, because until recently I was writing regularly for Time, and I did probably 25 pieces for them. One of the ones that seems to have gotten around the most, even though when I wrote it, I really thought of it as one of the treading water ones, I just had to do something that week, was I was saying that when we talk about the state of Black America, we can't pretend that there isn't a certain disproportion in terms of homicides. And I gave statistics, and of course, I gave some examples. And that piece deeply offended a lot of people. Many people seem to genuinely think that to say something like that means that you've been given some sort of cooked statistics, that the media isn't reporting on all of these white young male homicides, that there's a bias, etc. And so that means that we can't even, in good thinking society, talk about those things without being told that we're stereotyping. And I don't even need to look at how many likes and approvals Blow's piece has gotten. If we're really going to talk about responsibility, and talk about the legacies of Jim Crow, the legacies of slavery, etc. We have to at least be able to tell the truth. But within this conversation, it seems that to even do that is just to be subject to being corrected. That's the kind of conversation we're supposed to have. And that's a conversation that isn't real, won't convince anybody, and therefore I'm not sure it's worth having. That's one of my sources of impatience with the whole idea of a national reconciliation.
Well, I agree with, I think, at least one of the central themes in what you just said, which is that candor is a necessary ingredient to a productive conversation about race. And political correctness slash politeness is the enemy of candor in this area, and it can do a lot of damage. I certainly agree with that. I would reckon that people fear in a society where there are many different views competing out there, that the hard edge, kind of racist, anti-black sentiments would get moral support to the extent that one engages in such candid, acknowledgement of shortcomings in the community, and that especially black persons like you and myself ought not to be lending our support to that. So I think that's kind of one of the impediments to having a genuinely productive conversation.
It's not only political correctness, though. I think the obstacle is even harder in a way. I think many people really don't know that these disparities can be real. Many people have been trained to think that the smart take on it is to think that if you hear about a disparity like that, then the person must be distorting something. And they think that that's where it stops, that anytime you hear about something black people are doing, you should be suspicious, which you should. But that, of course, often gets taken to you should be permanently suspicious because disparities like those are never what they seem. I remember I was writing a piece for The Root, and I was writing about the use of the F word that refers to gay men. And I was talking about stand-up comedians, and I was saying that with black stand-up comedy, as wonderful as it is, I think that it would be fair to say that using the F word with six letters with abandon is something we might want to rein in, given that this is perhaps the new civil rights movement. And one of the copy editors, clearly decided that my saying that this was something more common in black stand-up comedy must be wrong. And she pointed me to Louis C.K., supposedly using the F word often. And I hadn't watched the Louis show yet at the time. This was a long time ago. But now that I've seen it, he doesn't throw the word around. There's one episode where they discuss it, but that's different. But this copy editor was a very smart person who was basing her response to my piece on that sense that no, it couldn't be that there is this disparity. That's how this reparations conversation would take place. People who really believe that these disparities are something to show the unreality of, in which case we wind up just stuck. And I think that the Coates piece for me is a call for that kind of crabbed conversation, as sincere as I think he is.
I didn't quite read him that way. I read him more in the spirit of let's tell our history fully. Let's not sugarcoat or prettify it. And if we tell the real history of the race in the 20th century, it will be littered with one example after another of exclusion, oppression, cheating, dispossession, segregation, discrimination, and that's relevant to today. So we can't understand our current circumstance without taking that on board. That's how I would have read him. But I wondered if I may just to go back to the issue of disparity, because it's not just the op-eds, Charles Blow reacting to Mark Cuban or whatever. It seems to me that that there's some seriously flawed thinking about racial disparities that's infected the way we discuss a lot of issues. So, for example, there was a big piece in the newspaper not long ago about breast cancer survivor rates. These are women with breast cancer, and the death rates are higher amongst African American women. And this disparity has expanded as the ability of the medical establishment to effectively respond to a diagnosis of breast cancer has improved. With better treatment and better techniques for intervention, the disparity has expanded. Now, this is not my field of expertise, but I gathered from reading this long piece and listening to the testimony of experts in the field that one of the reasons is that African American women are slower to avail themselves of the newly evolving therapies, which are able to, extend life or maybe even prevent death from breast cancer, in comparison to non-Black women. Now, partly that may be because they're poor and they don't have access to health care. But as I read in the fine print of this study, I searched in vain for an extended treatment of what might be cultural reasons why people are not
That's been written
engaging with
about
the
at some
healthcare
points.
system in the same way. So, and similarly, I'll give one more example, the disparity in the expulsions or suspensions of youngsters from school. Now, the Obama administration has mounted the Equal Opportunity Office at the Department of Education, a full-bore effort to identify and hold accountable, school systems, districts in which you have these kinds of racial disparities in the suspension rates. And the thing that troubled me in the back of my mind was, yes, these disparities are there, and one imagines that it could be because administrators are treating more harshly a behavior that, when they see it in a Black, they take to be threatening and criminal and worthy of suspension, which they won't react to in the same way in the whites. But another possibility, of course, and one has to think this when one looks at the differences in the rates of arrest and conviction for criminal offenses, that there really might be different patterns of behavior. In the Black student coming out of the communities where 5 years hence, some of those same young men are going to be getting into trouble with the law, and that could at least account for part of the racial disparity. Now, it's really, really hard to get that kind of, when you have a disparity and when the first order explanation of it is discrimination, but if you kind of dig beneath the surface, other possible explanations, those that don't make white people responsible for the disparity, come up. It's very hard to get them taken seriously by a lot of people, black and white, I think.
Oh, yeah. There are people whose whole careers, I'm thinking of one person in particular who I'm not going to name, but there are people whose whole careers are based on an animus against the education system's bias against black boys. And there is that bias, without a doubt. But then on the other hand, it's hard not to see, and this, even from the studies that I've seen, and I'm not an expert on this, but I've waded around the literature a bit. It's hard not to see that there are some statistical behavioral issues. But it seems that there are only two outcomes that one could have in the quote-unquote conversation like that. You see somebody giving a talk about it, and the room is just applauding at the very mention of black boys. The room is a fan of black boys and wants to protect them. And so the idea that the black boys themselves might be the cause of this disparate discipline to any extent is completely unwelcome. You're not going to talk about that any more than you would blow on a tuba in the middle of a funeral. And to the extent that over drinks somebody might admit that there is that disparity, the idea is that, well, racism of various forms is responsible for that disparity. And so it really all comes back to the same thing. And despite the fact that all the people who are saying these things have good intentions and are making important points, that conversation cannot create the healing that we're responsible for, because once again, the link between the black boy's behavior in the classroom and the feelings of white America about black people, or the operations of the system that make it harder to be a black person, are so abstract and so flowchart sequential and difficult and controversial that there couldn't be the reconciliation. But Glenn, I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Do you think that America is blind to its racist history? This is a major component of the argument as we're having it now about reparations, that America isn't aware. And I really don't get it. I mean, I don't think everybody is a historian, but I don't see America not understanding that black people have had it hard. What do you think people mean by that?
I guess I'm going to repeat myself now. I guess that they're saying this history has had huge consequences in the present, but people have amnesia. Now, the amnesia is not of the form that they never heard of lynchings, or they don't know there was slavery, or they don't realize that Brown versus Board of Education didn't happen until mid-20th century, nearly 100 years after emancipation. It's not that. Certainly they're aware of that. It's that they don't appreciate the profound implications of this history for the structures that we're embedded in today. They act as if the country has remade itself. We had all of that, yes, but we had a civil rights movement. We have the Civil Rights Act. We had affirmative action ad nauseum. And now let's move on. We've got a lot of immigrants who are not European in origin, who are coming to the country and climbing the ladder of prosperity. Let's move on. It's time to move on. I think that's what people are lamenting, the tendency of wanting to, you know, not erase history, but maybe whitewash a little bit, or just not appreciate the heavy overhang. You know, the history casts a long shadow. They think we're out of the shadow. And other people who are objecting, saying we don't remember our history, think we still labor under the shadow of that history. That's what I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's an extent to which I can't help detecting among many people who are claiming that America doesn't understand this history, a certain smugness, and I don't mean only black people. I read a piece last night by one Alyssa Rosenberg, who's a smart commentator, and she seemed to be under the impression, in response to Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece, that in general, America tends to think that a movie like Gone with the Wind is a serious depiction of slavery as opposed to something like 12 years of slavery. And she notes that, you know, it can be argued that 2% of either the American public or the American viewing public actually saw 12 years of slavery, despite how much has been discussed in certain circles. And her idea seems to be that really America thinks slavery was like Gone with the Wind. But does America think that to any appreciable degree, or is it that we're often told that they do, especially if we're reading people, we like to know that we're somehow in on the truth. How many people really think that slaves were happy on the plantation? And you can pick out something like what Paula Deen said last summer with her nostalgia for seeing black men wearing white, etc. But who's to say that that's what the typical person walking down the street thinks slavery was? I'm not sure where we get that idea.
No, I don't think that's it, John. I mean, that's froth. I mean, surely there are Paula Deen-like statements which can be taken to represent a cluelessness and so on. But I think, so I just got through reading with my two sons. We have a little family book club. Every other month, we get together and discuss a book. And it's a lot of fun. A novel. Historical novel by Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian novelist, Nobel Prize winner, called The Dream of the Celt. Now, bear with me, I'm going somewhere with this. It's about the life of a man named Roger Casement. And Roger Casement was executed by the British Crown for collaborating with the Germans on behalf of his dream of Irish independence in 1916. But he had been knighted. He was Sir Roger Casement when he was executed by the British Crown as a traitor during World War I. And he had been knighted because of two huge humanitarian expeditions that he undertook. One into the Congo, into the jungles of the Congo, the interior of Central Africa, to document the abuses of the Belgian overlords who were getting rubber out of the rainforest and were, just making a mess of all the villages and enslaving people and cutting off their hands, blah, blah, blah. And the other, up the Amazon, the Peruvian Amazon, into the jungle. Similarly, now it was Spanish barons of rubber extraction, and they were exploiting the indigenous people. And Casement wrote two big reports that had a huge political impact, and he was knighted for his service. Now, I say all of that to say this. We know that the colonialists exploited the indigenous populations of Africa and of Latin America on behalf of their greed and their effort to get raw materials out and ship them to Europe and make a lot of money. But we have no idea about the detailed brutality and kind of all-consuming abuse and the kind of savagery of this thing. I mean, I'm talking about the details. I'm talking about what it's like on the ground. When I saw 12 Years a Slave, I had never seen anything like it in terms of representing that. That being the kind of almost unbearable, disgusting, inhumanity of man to man. And I think a lot of people don't realize, I heard someone make this remark. I thought it was really very good. Slavery was not just, expropriating people's labor. I mean, it was a wholesale system of human subjugation, and it also, was very debilitating to the moral fiber of the people who were on the top of that system. And I think that's the kind of thing that it might, and what? Okay, so what's the relevance of that today? I mean, that's another question. I'm just saying when people say people don't really understand slavery, I think of the fact that I didn't really understand what colonial exploitation of native populations was until I read some of the sort of thick description that's provided, for example, in Vargas Llosa's novel.
I understand that completely, and I'm going to ask a question that one is not supposed to, but that I think a great many people feel that are asking themselves, but feel that you're not supposed to put it on Twitter, you're not supposed to put it in the comment section, you're not supposed to mention it at the party. Let's say that everybody did understand it to that exquisite degree. So what? I don't get why that's so important. I think we are trained to hear calls for that kind of understanding and say, oh, yes, of course, we must. But why must the rest of America understand it to that extent, given that a lot of people, what they're really thinking, I'm going to take a leap, is yes, those things happened. There are even some things happening now, but almost no human group has it easy. And you make the most of it, especially in a country like this one. And why, and I'm not something as simplistic as why are you so obsessed with the past, but why must the country have such an exquisite understanding of what your problems have been? And I think that's a legitimate question. And what worries me about this, what just viscerally doesn't taste good, and we're all moved by things like that to an extent, is that I feel like what's really going on is a basic sense among many people that a fundamental aspect of a constructive black identity is grievance. And to the extent that the barriers to success are removed, and they are definitely still there, but to the extent that we're not talking about water fountains, we're not talking about redlining, it seems that there's a certain kind of person who wants to stick with the basic sense that you have to be in a battle pose. And so somehow, for us, with our specific history, we can't really move on. A shoe hasn't dropped until people across the nation are fully aware of the exquisite detail of what we've been through. And I ask, why? I don't see why that's so important.
Let me respond with another analogy. Why would it be important to have the picture of the conquest of the West that proceeds from early 19th century through early 20th century, and that involves basically the extermination of the native peoples of the North American continent, to have that story told not in terms of cowboys and Indians and covered wagons circled and all of that, but to have it told in terms of the bitter harvest of the native people who were driven from their land, starved and frozen to death, herded into reservations, stripped of their culture, and dehumanized. And one reason would not be about the native people at all. It wouldn't just be their, it's not just their story. One reason would be to see America for what it actually has been, rather than this kind of, you know, city on a hill exceptionalism that the fairy tale makers prefer. So it might be that I would be a less arrogant superpower, less inclined to project my military forces onto small countries and to try to dominate them, if I had a less arrogant and, you know, self-loving image of my own history, this kind of thing. So I just want to make the point. The stakes here are not just about black people getting something. I agree with you that those grievance mongers are there, and it is an occupation. It can be a well-paid one. But the stakes here are about the country itself, not just about black people, understanding itself in a proper light.
And if some Lithuanian observer, picking a random country, came and assessed this issue, I think that he or she would be baffled at the idea that this country hasn't done, to a considerable extent, exactly what you're saying. And so, for example, no, everybody hasn't seen 12 Years a Slave. Everybody doesn't see every movie. But in these times that we're living in, 12 Years a Slave, The Butler, The Help. Major release movies, widely discussed. Anybody these days can see those movies at the press of a button that rather graphically display, some of them in new ways, aspects of the black past that everybody ought to know. More than that, the book about the harvesting of the cells of Henrietta Lacks.
Oh, yeah.
That book has been a nonfiction bestseller for years and sold way too well for it to only be black women who were buying it. Sure. Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow.
Indeed.
Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns, about the Great Migration. These things are there. Now, some people seem to have this notion that somehow none of this counts unless every member of the population over the age of 10 somehow passes some sort of test. Every man on every bar stool, every Indian immigrant, everybody. And I'm not sure that that could ever happen. I don't see the denial here. People seem to be waiting for something more than where we are, but I'm not sure they're really thinking about where we are. They just seem to be making the demand. America turns away. That phraseology does not match the country that I've been living in for the past 48 years. Now, it matched America in 1950, maybe even in 1970, but America isn't turning away. There's an exquisite perfection desired here, a kind of stage managing that I am not sure of the real purpose of. I'm not even sure if we're talking about something real. Is this posturing?
Well, I want to make a substantive comment in a moment, and I want to just react very briefly to what you just said, which is I think that we have to bear in mind, you and I, that our lens of vision, our angle of vision on the world, you know, we're both at Ivy League universities, for example, and we know that in our student bodies, we don't see this amnesia or this indifference to our racial history, quite the opposite. But it might be that if you were pumping gas somewhere in Muncie, Indiana, or, you know, somewhere in
Sure.
Idaho or Oklahoma, it would be a
Yeah.
different story. That was a small comment. If I may, I'd just like to express my own personal objection to the reviving of the reparations case that Ta-Nehisi Coates is engaged in. And I can say it succinctly. I don't think racial claims are a good strategy going forward. I think universal claims are the best strategy going forward. That is, I think the issue here is about what kind of country is America, not about how is America going to deal with its blacks. And I think that if we ask why the social policy terrain in the United States is so thin, why there's so little help for people, why we have so many people on the outs, so many people who are unable to realize the full potential of their humanity in comparison to other wealthy countries with capitalist democracies and so forth, like Denmark or Holland or Germany or even the United Kingdom and France, that's the big challenge for us. And while race may well historically have played a role in generating this circumstance, there's no way that race and racial claims are the way forward to remedy the circumstance of an inadequate social provision. And so, as I've said before here, African Americans need to find a way to take our historical experience and tie it to a progressive advocacy going forward that's universal and not particularistic, in its intonation.
That may be true, but I don't see it. The kind of people who are most staunchly behind this idea of reparations that has come back to us since its discussion in 2000 surrounding Randall Robinson's book The Debt, which presented a lot of the same kinds of arguments that Ta-Nehisi Coates' piece does. I don't see them viscerally interested. I mean, intellectually, sure. You can talk about Cornel West and Tavis Smiley going around the country battling poverty, and I'm not saying they're insincere. But viscerally, there is a sense that there is a particular black problem. We're only just getting used to the idea of talking about poor black people and equally poor whites in the same breath. And there's a residual sense, and I wouldn't even say it's residual, that somehow the white ones are beside the point because they're white and they haven't had as much of a hard time from history, that it's the black thing that we really have to be talking about. And my takeaway feeling about the reparations issue is that if it could happen, the money and or a big national conversation, it wouldn't work. I can't see it working. I can't, and this may be a limitation of my vision, maybe I'll feel differently about this in 5 years. I cannot see the relevant people after anything that happened, no matter how it happened, saying, okay, it's been done. The nation understands, and now we can move on. It's done. They couldn't. There's just no constitutional way that that could be accepted, unless America became perfect. Which it wouldn't. There would still be idiots in the comment sections. People would still be saying some things on the radio. There would still be disparities. And as long as those were there, there would be a vocal contingent of people saying it didn't really happen. We still have to keep going. We have to have another conversation. Which makes me chary of the notion of even starting one because it couldn't work. I don't think that the people in question are really after a solution. I feel like it's really just an ongoing statement. Am I too cynical in
No,
that?
you may be right about them, put that in inverted commas, the people who write these kinds of op-eds and who make these kinds of advocacy claims. But I think they're increasingly less relevant. And for example, I'm going to make a prediction. Barack Obama is practically a lame duck already, and everyone is anticipating his post-presidency. And I'm prepared to go out on a limb and predict that at least one of the principal planks of the post-presidential platform that Barack and Michelle Obama will attempt to erect as they try to fashion their place in American history will be around moving from the race-specific to the national and universalistic plane. I mean, trying to, as I say, leverage the whatever influence and attention-grabbing power one has by calling attention to the very real mistreatment of African Americans in a way that can then be used to try to say, well, we should rethink our broad-based social policy in the following way, whether it be our tax policy or how we deal with our cities and their finances or what we do about providing health care to people, which is underway, or so on and so forth, to try to do the thing that he hasn't been able to do on the political hot seat, which is fulfill the promise of that speech that he gave in 2004 about not a black America, a white America, not a red America or a blue America. I do think there's an opportunity there for somebody. And in that space, the grievance mongers are going to have very little traction, I'm thinking.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I would be hard pressed to identify a grievance monger. In my time on the race writing trail, I have never met anybody who wasn't truly sincere. And I'm sure that you have noticed the same thing. There's nobody who you get a sense is sort of winking and writing in a certain way because it pays their bills or because they want to get a rise out of it.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah, I don't know any grievance mongers. What is most challenging about all of this is that all the people who are writing these things are sincere. I mean, in their own heads, they are doing something that they really mean and they have the best of intentions. And it frustrates me to think, somebody who's doing that, which is exactly what I do, I find myself not agreeing. And then I also know that my not agreeing will be read by many people as insincere and as, you know, uninformed, et cetera, et cetera. These are tough, tough arguments. But so I don't think that the grievance monger would keep writing because they need to mong grievance. I think it's because there's a sense that you're not doing your duty, that you are not keeping the struggle going if you are not, you know, monging grievance, or even that there is no such thing as the struggle ending, that if you think that any aspect of the struggle is over, then you are leaving people behind. You have missed your mission.
Let me ask you a question. I'm sorry to interrupt. No, the question was going to be, there was something about, and we're talking now about a particular individual, I'm talking about Charles Blow. At the end of his column on Mark Cuban, he has a sentence, something to the effect of, after he's made a declaration, and that's how, if we're going to have a conversation about race, it has to be like this. Mm-hmm. And I thought, who appointed you, the national school marm, to direct the conversation? You know, you get to tell me, or a white guy, or a Chinese guy, how they're supposed to talk about race? Really? We got to run it past you.
Yeah, and he also, <You know? laughs> and he thinks he accomplished it. You know, I have corrected him basically by saying you, Mark Cuban, are stereotyping. But he hasn't corrected him. That really only opens up a whole new wing of what a Mark Cuban might say. And if Blow thinks that the way it's going to go is that column, that it's really going to be as easy as somebody says something a little naive and somebody like Charles Blow corrects him, then we're up for nothing. Yeah, that the final sentence of that column says it all. And Charles Blow is no idiot.
If it rubbed me the wrong way, and I'm on his team, okay, you can imagine how it's going to affect somebody who thinks Mark Cuban is a great guy and who happens not to be black and who's sitting in Dallas, Texas. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
I know exactly what you're saying.
Good talking to you. Let's move on to the next thing today. What do you say?
Yeah, yeah. It is time to move on to the next thing today, but let's talk again very soon.
Righto. Thanks again.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Bye.